Milwaukee and Baltimore. However, the reigning Cy Young winner said that he's happy with his progress thus far. Cole's elbow hasn't been an issue since his throwing program began on April 8th. It's kind of a similar ramp up to what an off season would be like. Cole said, that's kind of what we're working off of just trying to nail it, not go too fast, not go too slow either. I'm out to 120, so it's moving along. DJ LeMahieu, working his way back from a non-displaced fracture in his right foot, began a rehab assignment at AA Somerset on Tuesday. Boone said the initial plan is for the third baseman to play in 4 minor league games. In addition to Tuesday's contest, LeMahieu is expected to play on Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. Boone said there's a chance LeMahieu joins the Yankees for their trip to Baltimore next week. Anthony Rizzo took a .227 average and just 1 home run into Tuesday's action. The typically slick fielder has also made a few mishaps in the field this season. I do believe last night Rizzo did hit a home run, so that would be his second. Because the first baseman played and scuffled through both concussion symptoms last year, some have wondered if he is okay. Rizzo also has had recurring back issues in the past. Yeah, Rizzo succinctly said Monday when asked if he's healthy. As for his struggles, Rizzo said, it's a grind. Take it one day at a time. I'm seeing the ball well. I just have to take better swings. Seeing the ball was an issue for Rizzo last year. So far this season, Boone said the veteran could benefit from being a little more selective. He's probably chasing results a little bit and aware that he hasn't hit for a lot of power yet, Boone said. So maybe even by his standards, you start expanding a little bit more. Back on April 1st, it was announced the Yankees pitching prospect Tristan Verlaine would make his affiliated pro debut at AA Somerset. The 2022 third-round pick spent his draft year at the Yankees complex in Tampa, and he missed the 2023 campaign with a stress fracture in his elbow. Still, the Yankees felt the 23-year-old could handle AA. I think they feel good about a college kid with a pretty good pedigree who throws strikes, Matt Blake told the Daily News when the decision was made. They felt good about pushing him a little bit. Verlaine has responded well to the nudge, recording a 0.48 ERA, 18 strikeouts, and 6 walks over 3 starts in 18 and 2/3 innings. The righty ranked the Yankees' 23rd best prospect by MLB.com, most recently held the Hartford Yard Goats hitless over 7 and 2/3 innings on April 19. On Tuesday, Verlaine was named the Eastern League Pitcher of the Week. And I don't have much time left. I'm just going to touch on that article that I mentioned at the beginning on UConn's Christian Haynes. For a program that hasn't had much success in the field the last decade, UConn has developed and sent a number of players to the NFL with solid reputations. The latest will be Christian Haynes, interior lineman, in which experts see the positional size and advanced skill level to be a starter in the league. Haynes started 49 games at right guard in college, noted Mel Kiper Jr., ESPN's draft analyst, and he allowed just 1 sack over his final 3 seasons. He's my number 3 ranked player at the position. Kiper, in his mock draft April 10th, projected Haynes as the 55th pick in the draft going to Miami in the second round. NFL.com's Lance Zierlein rates Haynes as a late second or early third round pick. Haynes plays with football intelligence and sees every snap as a mandate to move opponents and finish blocks, Zierlein writes. His draft slotting could be affected by a lack of length and being limited to one position, but his determined playing style counters those factors. He's not overly rangy, but wipes out targets on pulling blocks and is capable in space and in pass protection. The hand usage can get sloppy, allowing opponents to slip away from him, and he has a tendency to do too much grabbing. All things considered, he might outplay his draft slotting and become a solid NFL starter. NFL DraftBuzz.com projects Haynes in the second round, emerging from a modest 2-star recruit in 2018, the site reports. Christian Haynes has defied expectations, becoming a linchpin for Connecticut's offensive line with an impressive 49 consecutive starts at right guard. Over his collegiate career, Haynes distinguished himself not just through durability, but also with back-to-back third-team All-American honors in his junior year. And what's on the air today? Not too much. Baseball, we have 6 p.m. Boston at Cleveland on NESN, Radio 1080 WTIC, 7 p.m. Oakland at the Yankees, Prime Video, Radio 97.9. In hockey, East Conference first-round playoff, Boston and Toronto, Game 3 on ESPN. The Western Conference first-round playoff, Vegas at Dallas, Game 2, ESPN. And at 10 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Los Angeles at Edmonton, Game 2, on TBS. And that is it for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Thanks for spending this part of your day with Chris, Connecticut's Talking News Stand.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. Take a look in at the pictures on the front pages of each paper. An overhead shot. This is a picture on the Times front page. It says, "Where politics and water mix." And I will read the caption. Green alfalfa fields sprawl for miles alongside a town of dirt. Lots in Arizona where Democrats see an opening as water takes center stage as a political issue. And just as it says, it's an overhead shot. You can see it looks like a neighborhood underneath the picture of the alfalfa field. So that will be my story. I'm going to read that story from the Times. And a nice picture over on the Current. It says, "Frolic in Flowers." There are three pictures. First one, a larger one, Isla Kretschmer. She's 5 years old, and she's there with her sister, Romy Kretschmer, and she's two. And they play along the flowers at the Robert A. Prill Tulip Garden at the Elizabeth Park Conservancy in West Hartford on Tuesday. It says Ayla and Romy are visiting from California with their mom, and they're frolicking through. Their cute little girls with dresses on, having a great time frolicking through the beautiful tulips. Underneath is a picture of a lady. Her name is Sierra Jackson. She's of Dallas, and she's standing among the tulips for photos. And the third picture is a picture of Lindy Nolan. She is enjoying tulips with her daughter, Rebecca Wood, and their 16-month-old granddaughter, Amelia Wood. They're lying down and looking at the flowers. So those are the pictures on the front page of the Current. And I'm going to read that story now that accompanies the picture that I just described in the New York Times. It is from La Paz County, Arizona. In Arizona's deeply conservative La Paz County, the most urgent issue facing many voters is not inflation or illegal immigration. It is the water being pumped from under their feet. Giant farms have turned Arizona's remote deserts about 100 miles west of Phoenix as green as fairways, the product of extracting an ocean of groundwater to grow alfalfa for dairy cows. Water experts say the pumping is sinking poor rural towns. The ground in parts of La Paz County has dropped more than 5 feet during 3 decades of farming. Pipes and home foundations are cracking. Wells are running dry. What's going to happen if they take all the water? Asked Luis Zavala, 48, who emigrated from Mexico 2 decades ago to pick cantaloupes, another water-intensive crop that has been mostly replaced by hay for cows. And the article continues, now he works at a water and ice business in Salome, population 700, selling 5-gallon jugs. Even as political battles over abortion consume Arizona's capital, Democrats have seized on water as a life-or-death election issue that they hope gives them an opening, however slight, to reach out to rural voters. Water made me attorney general, said Chris Mays, a first term Democrat who campaigned on cracking down on farms in western Arizona. This is exactly the kind of issue we can win back some of the rural America. Summers of record-setting heat and drought have raised doubts for many Arizonians about whether the state has enough water to sustain its farms and fast-growing cities. Rural residents say they are particularly vulnerable. They have fewer sources of water and less money than big cities like Phoenix for larger reservoirs or new wastewater treatment plants, and they do not have the authority of urban areas to stop unlimited pumping. A survey last month by Noble Predictive Insights, a Phoenix pollster, found that 60% of voters believe that the state is running out of water. Still, Democrats face suspicion in places like La Paz County, a patchwork of emerald-colored farm valleys and scorched mountain ranges whose mild winters draw retirees in RVs and van life vagabonds. For years, populist Pinto Democrats, named for the multicolored horse breed, survived in these rural corners of Arizona like cactuses in a hostile desert. They supported gun rights, defense, and infrastructure projects that slashed federal money around the community, said Tom Zollner, author of Rim to River, a chronicle of Arizona's history and politics. In 1996, La Paz narrowly supported Bill Clinton's re-election, while Arizona's biggest urban county, Maricopa, went for his Republican opponent. But now, La Paz population, 17,000, reflects much of rural America's transformation into bedrock of MAGA land that accelerated with former President Donald J. Trump's appeal to disaffected white voters. Winter residents playing billiards at the Cactus Bar wear Let's Go Brandon t-shirts mocking President Biden, and Trump flags flap from the off-road desert buggies that rumble through the mountains. Mr. Trump gained ground over Democrats in rural places in 2020, winning 65% of rural votes compared with 59% in 2016. According to the Pew Research Center, La Paz County has gone even deeper red, even after denying that there was a drought in California and proposing deep cuts to the federal agency that oversees major western water projects. Mr. Trump won La Paz by 40 points in 2020. Some of his voters scoffed at the idea that the Democrats' water offensive could make them reconsider their politics. Absolutely not, said Jim Downing, an engineer who works with farms in the area. He accused Democrats and the news media of concocting a water crisis for purely political reasons and said that big farms had been demonized for taking advantage of a legally available resource. Nevertheless, he joined a crowd of about 150 at the public library in Wendon, a La Paz farming town, one afternoon in April to hear Miss Mays talk about water. The turnout was far higher than the few dozen local officials had been hoping for. Miss Mays had been canvassing the sites of Arizona's water crises. She has held packed meetings in rural communities where groundwater pumping by a huge dairy farm has opened up fissures in the earth, or where people 400-foot deep wells are going dry. She pointed out that she and Governor Katie Hobbs, a first-term Democrat, had gone after a Saudi-owned farm in La Paz County soon after taking office last year. Critics said the farm, Fondamonte, had been pumping nearly unlimited amounts of water on land that at least cheaply from the state to grow alfalfa for export in the Middle East. Ms. Hobbs canceled Fondamente's leases on the state land. The company is appealing. In a statement, Fondamente said it continued to farm on other properties and used innovative ways to reduce water consumption. The company has said it was the third largest private employer in the county and generates $145 million annually in economic activity for the state. Miss Mays told the crowd in Wendon that she was investigating whether she could sue to stop the large farms. She argued that the erosion, road damage, failing water tables, and other damage created by huge farms could potentially violate Arizona's nuisance laws. I'm going to go over to the Hartford Current, and I have a few stories on the front page of the Current. Here is the first one. State employees received final approval Tuesday for pay raises of roughly 4.5% for the next fiscal year, prompting approval from Democrats and sharp skepticism from many Republicans. The contract covers 46,000 employees and includes a 2.5% general wage increase plus an annual step increase of about 2% for a total of 4.5%. The State House of Representatives approved the union deal by 106 to 44, with all negative votes coming from Republicans, although nine other Republicans voted for the agreement. The Senate voted 1 hour later in a similar manner on strict party lines, approving the measure by 24 to 12. The increase is part of a wage reopener in the fourth year of a four-year contract that was negotiated with the administration of Governor Ned Lamont and will cover the next fiscal year that starts on July 1st. House Speaker Matt Ritter, a Hartford Democrat, said the increase was needed as a raise for our hardworking state employees. That was a quote. State Representative Michael DiAgostino, a Democratic attorney who led the debate on the House floor, said, quote, our state employees are the backbone of our government. They are our lifeblood. We planned for this. We budgeted for this, end quote. The average salary for a state employee in Connecticut is about $75,000 per year, he said, adding that only a few coaches at the University of Connecticut earn more than $1 million per year. These are good middle-class jobs, DiAgostino said. They are the middle class here. They live here. They work here. This is a good deal. But Republicans said the raise would end up increasing the state budget that would eventually lead to increasing taxes or cutting spending. They noted that many groups, including nonprofits that perform state services under contracts, are still searching for additional funding as the state budget is only $1 million below the spending cap in a $26 billion annual budget. Lawmakers are scrambling to finish the overall spending plan before the regular legislative session ends on May 8th. Representative Tammy Nuccio of Talland, who serves as the ranking House Republican on the Budget Committee, said that one of the aspects that bothered her is that more state employees need to travel to the office rather than working remotely at home. I have a really hard time supporting any agreement that does not address work at home, Nuccio said. That weighs heavily on me with this contract. And we have another story, these two stories about the aid to Ukraine bill from Washington. The Senate voted overwhelmingly Tuesday to move ahead with $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, bringing the bill to the brink of passage after months of delays and contentious internal debate over how involved the United States should be abroad. The vote to end a filibuster drew the support of 80 senators, 10 more than supported the bill when the Senate first passed it in February, virtually guaranteeing that the bill would soon reach President Joe Biden's desk. The $61 billion for Ukraine comes as the war-torn country desperately needs new firepower and as Russian President Vladimir Putin has stepped up his attacks. Ukrainian soldiers have struggled to hold the front lines as Russia has seized the momentum on the battlefield and gained significant territory. Biden told Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky on Monday that the U.S. will send needed air defense weaponry as soon as the legislation is passed. The House approved the package Saturday in a series of four votes, sending it back to the Senate for final approval. The president has assured me that the package will be approved quickly and that it will be powerful, strengthening our air defense as well as long-range and artillery capabilities, Zelensky said in a post on the platform X. U.S. officials said the Pentagon is poised to send $1 billion in new military aid to Ukraine, the bulk of following in coming weeks. The legislation also would send $26 billion in wartime assistance to Israel and humanitarian relief to citizens of Gaza, and $8 billion to counter China and Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific. In an effort to gain more votes, Republicans in the House majority also added a bill to the package that could ban the social media app TikTok in the U.S. if its Chinese owners do not sell their stake within a year. The foreign aid portion of the bill is similar to what the Senate passed in February, with some minor changes and additions, including the TikTok bill and the stipulation that $9 billion of the economic assistance of Ukraine or to Ukraine is in the form of, quote, forgivable loans, unquote. Those changes appears to have brought nine additional Republicans on board, meaning a clear majority of the Senate GOP conference supports the legislation. February vote on an earlier version of the bill was 70-59. We're going to stop now for the weather. I'll have the national forecast from the New York Times and then the local forecast. Here's the national forecast. A storm beginning to move off the northeast coast today will produce showers and thunderstorms from this region to South Carolina. Steady rain may fall in northern New England. Rain may begin to mix with snow at times, mainly in the higher elevations of New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. As this storm exits, gusty winds from the north will bring colder air to the region. A developing storm will spread showers and thunderstorms from Nebraska to East Texas. Storms may also occur from northern California to Wyoming by the afternoon. As a new storm travels east of the northwest coast, showers may begin across western Washington. Much of the interior, southwest, and the Midwest will remain dry. And we'll take a quick break and be back with the local forecast.
Join us Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2:30 p.m. for the Reader's Digest on Chris.
The forecast for tonight is mostly clear, with a low around 29. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be sunny, with a high near 58. And tomorrow night will be clear, with a low around 32. Friday will be sunny, with a high near 62. And Friday night will be mostly clear, with a low around 38. Saturday will be mostly sunny, with a high near 62. And Saturday night, there's a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 45. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Another story on the front page of the Current. The $95 billion Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan aid package, headed for approval Tuesday by the U.S. Senate, contains a financial boost for submarine production of Electric Boat and dozens of supporting businesses scattered across the state. Tucked into the bill that survived a far-right Republican challenge in the U.S. House late last week is $2 billion for the businesses that make up what is known as the submarine industrial base, the suppliers and contractors struggling to meet aggressive new U.S. Navy sub-building targets. That industrial base investment matches $3 billion from Australians in support of AUKUS, AUKUS, the recently signed Australia, United Kingdom, U.S. Indo-Pacific Security Agreement, and another $6 billion stimulus the Pentagon proposes spending in the fiscal 2025 defense budget. The stimulus money, which has increased dramatically year over year, is intended to turbocharge a national shipbuilding base that has been idle for years as the Pentagon tries to rebuild a submarine fleet capable of meeting increasingly aggressive Chinese expansionism in Eastern Asia. Decades of flat post-Cold War spending shrunk the U.S. fleet by half. It almost depleted the ranks of welders, shipfitters, and riggers who build ships at the Pentagon's prime submarine contractor, the Electric Boat Division of General Dynamics in Groton, as well as the companies that supply them with parts, materials, and other services. As construction surges, the Navy is watching whether EB and thousands of manufacturers in its supply chain can hire and expand production quickly enough to meet not only U.S. fleet requirements, but the U.S. commitment to sell from 3 to 5 Virginal-class nuclear-powered attack submarines to Australia under AUKUS. There is language in AUKUS that authorizes whoever is U.S. president at the time of the proposed Australian sales to kill the deal if such a reduction in the U.S. fleet could negatively affect the national defense. Against that backdrop, Congress and the Navy have committed to building dozens of Columbia ballistic missile and Virginia attack submarines, the stealthiest, most technology-advanced and expensive weapons platforms ever. The plan calls for a dozen Columbias and 66 Virginias. To meet its national defense and AUKUS targets, the Navy says it needs EB and its shipbuilding partner, the Newport News Shipbuilding Division of Huntington Ingalls Industries, to deliver 2 Virginias and 1 Columbia a year by 2028. U.S. Representative Joe Courtney, Democrat of the 2nd District and a powerful voice in naval affairs, is a ranking member of the Sea Power Committee of the U.S. House Armed Services Committee, and he said in a recent letter to colleagues that EB was producing 1.4 Virginias a year, a build rate that exceeds the Navy's production curve. The Navy believes that their plan in terms of investing in the submarine industrial base will allow them to execute AUKUS with some confidence, Courtney said in an interview. However, Courtney and other committee members are challenging a Navy decision to break from recent tradition and fund 1 rather than 2 Virginia submarines in the upcoming defense bill. They argue the decision sends a wrong message to EB and hundreds of other businesses in the supply chain that have shown a willingness to invest billions of dollars in personnel and equipment in the expectation that the Navy will buy submarines at a constant rate over the coming decades. I'm seeking remarkable growth within the submarine industrial base that should not be overlooked, Courtney said in a letter to colleagues. That is why a bipartisan group of members and I strongly support maintaining procurement stability in Navy shipbuilding rather than cutting a procurement which will only exacerbate challenges on our Navy and industrial base. We're going to go to the World of Nations section now. From New York, Manhattan prosecutors are arguing the judge in the criminal case against former President Donald Trump to hold Trump in contempt of court for attacking witnesses and jurors, saying Trump's statements pose a threat to the landmark trial. Jury selection in the case had hardly begun last week when prosecutors accused Trump of violating a gag order in the case, which centers on a hush money payment to a porn performer that could have derailed his 2016 campaign. The order imposed by the judge overseeing the case, Juan Merchant, bars the former president from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, jurors, and court staff, as well as their relatives. Prosecutors said Trump violated it 11 times, both in his own statements and by reposting quotes and articles on social media, arguing that he risked inciting violence or harassment. Trump has directed many of his attacks at a key prosecution witness, Michael Cohen, his former fixer, as well as the porn performer Stormy Daniels, who has alleged a sexual encounter with Trump. In court Tuesday, one of the prosecutors, Christopher Conroy, rattled off Trump's various statements that may have crossed the line, including calling Cohen and Daniels sleaze bags. He also noted that Trump last week reposed an attack on the jury pool and that one juror who had already been seated subsequently asked to be excused from the panel. What happened here was exactly what this order was meant to prevent, and the defendant doesn't care, Conroy said. The prosecutors from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office had asked Merchant to fine Trump $1,000 per violation, and Conroy said Tuesday they were not seeking jail time, although he believed that this is what Trump might have been angling for. Trump lawyer Todd Blanche argued that Trump's posts were political in nature and did not violate the order because he was simply responding to a barrage of political attacks from Cohen and others. But Merchant appeared to bristle at that claim, saying he did not want to get into the interpreting and reading between the lines of Trump's posts. As Blanche complained that Conroy had ample time to make his argument, Merchant dressed down the lawyer, injecting, "I am asking the questions, okay, and I'm going to decide whether your client is in contempt or not, so please don't turn it around." Blanche appeared flummoxed and frustrated by Merchant, who remarked that one of the defense's arguments was silly and noted that some of Trump's posts were false. "I need to know what is true," Merchant said before uttering the words no lawyer ever wants to hear from a judge. "You're losing all credibility with the court." From New York, a veteran tabloid publisher testified Tuesday that he pledged to be Donald Trump's eyes and ears during the 2016 presidential campaign by Trump, recounting how he promised the then candidate that he would help suppress harmful stories and even arranged to purchase the silence of a doorman. The testimony from David Pecker was designed to bolster the prosecution's premise of a decades-long friendship between Trump and the former publisher of the National Enquirer that culminated in an agreement to give the candidate's lawyer a heads-up on negative tips and stories so they could be quashed. The effort to suppress unflattering information was designed to illegally influence the election, prosecutors have alleged, in striving to elevate the gravity of the first trial of a former U.S. president and the first of four criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. Pecker is the first witness against Trump, who faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with the hush money payments meant to prevent harmful stories from surfacing in the 2016 campaign. With Trump sitting just feet away in the courtroom, Pecker detailed his intimate behind-the-scenes involvement in Trump's rise from political office to the Republican nomination and the White House. He explained how he and the National Enquirer parlayed rumor mongering into splashy tabloid stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress sordid stories about Trump, including a porn actor's claim of an extramarital sexual encounter a decade earlier. Pecker traced the origins of the relationship to a 1980s meeting at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and said the friendship bloomed alongside the success of the real estate developer's TV show The Apprentice and the program's subsequent celebrity version. Their ties were solidified during a pivotal August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower, including involving Trump, his lawyer and personal fixer Michael Cohen, and another aide, Hope Hicks, in which Pecker was asked what he and the publications he led could do for the campaign. Pecker said he volunteered to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. But that wasn't all, he said, telling jurors how he told Trump, "I will be your eyes and ears. I said that anything I hear in the marketplace, if I hear anything negative about yourself, or if I hear about women selling stories, I would notify Michael Cohen so that the rights could be purchased and the stories could be killed, so they would not get published," asked prosecutor Joshua Steinglass. "So they would not get published," Pecker replied. From Detroit, the U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016, a critical time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of treatment for sports injuries. Nusser worked at Michigan State University and also served as a team doctor at Indianapolis-based USA Gymnastics. He's now serving decades in prison for assaulting female athletes, including medal-winning Olympic gymnasts. Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Meiser said Nusser betrayed the trust of those in its care for decades and that the allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset. And while these settlements won't undo the harm Nusser inflicted, our hope is that they will help give the victims of his crimes some of the critical support they need to continue healing, Meiser said of the agreement to settle 139 claims. The Justice Department has acknowledged that it failed to step in for more than a year. FBI agents in Indianapolis and Los Angeles knew of allegations against them, but apparently took no action, an internal investigation found. FBI Director Christopher Wray was contrite and blunt when he spoke to survivors at a Senate hearing in 2021. The assault survivors include decorated Olympian Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Ali Raisman. I'm sorry that so many different people let you down over and over again, Ray said. And I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop this monster back in 2015 and failed. And we are back with the World and Nation page of The Current from Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukrainian Commander Oleksiy Tarasenko witnessed a frightening shift last month in Russia's efforts to punch through Kyiv's defense of the industrial region known as the Donbas. Standing against Russia's unyielding advance in the strategic frontline town of Chasiv Yar, he noticed that instead of making typical light infantry assaults, Moscow's forces were taking brazen risks by launching battalion and platoon-sized attacks, sometimes with up to 10 combat vehicles. His men destroyed up to 80 tanks in the weeks that followed, but it did not slow the enemy. The confidence of the Russian military reflected the Kremlin's knowledge that Ukraine's ammunition supplies were dwindling as the U.S. dawdled over approving more military aid. Saturday's passage by the House of Representatives of a much-awaited $61 billion package for Ukraine puts the country a step closer to an infusion of new firepower that will be rushed to the front line to fight Moscow's latest attacks. But the clock is ticking. With Russia using all its might to achieve its most significant gains since invasion by a May 9th deadline, when Moscow commemorates World War II Victory Day, in the meantime, Kyiv has no choice but to wait for replenishment. Seeing a window of opportunity, Russia has seized the momentum on the battlefield and forced Kyiv's forces to cede tactically significant territory, one painful yard after another. Wave after wave of mechanized units came for Tarasenko's brigade, protected under an umbrella of attack, drones, and artillery fire. They reached the foot of Chasiv Yar, which is the gateway to Ukraine's defensive backbone in the Donetsk region. They concentrated disproportionately enormous resources in this direction, said Tarasenko, deputy commander of the 5th Separate Assault Brigade. The most difficult thing is to cope with this constant onslaught from the enemy, which does not change even though the enemy is losing a lot of military equipment and soldiers. The Pentagon has said it could get weapons moving to Ukraine within days if the Senate and President Joe Biden give final approval to the aid package, but experts and Ukrainian lawmakers said it could take weeks for the assistance to reach troops, giving Russia more time to degrade Ukrainian defenses. The 7-month effort to pass the package effectively held Ukraine hostage to the internal politics of its biggest ally. It also raised concerns about how the shifting sands of American politics will influence future military support. From New York, what began last week when students at a New York Ivy League school refused to end their protests against Israel's war with Hamas had turned into a much larger movement by Tuesday, as students across the nation set up encampments occupy buildings, and ignore demands to leave. Protests against the war have been bubbling for months, but kicked into a higher gear after more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had camped out on Columbia University's Upper Manhattan campus were arrested Thursday. Dozens more protesters have been arrested at other campuses since, and many now face charges of trespassing or disorderly conduct. With tensions at Columbia continuing to run high and some students afraid to set foot on the campus, officials said the university will switch to a hybrid learning for the rest of the semester. Like many universities, Columbia is counting down till the end of the semester, with its final day of classes scheduled for Monday and exams finishing by the end of next week. At nearby New York University, police said 133 protesters were taken into custody late Monday and all had been released with summonses to appear in court on disorderly conduct charges. New York City Mayor Eric Adams said police officers were hit with bottles and other objects at some of this week's protests. In Connecticut, police arrested 60 protesters, including 47 students, Monday at Yale University after they refused to leave an encampment. Yale President Peter Salovey said protesters had declined an offer to end the demonstration and meet with trustees. After several warnings, school officials determined, quote, the situation was no longer safe, unquote, so police cleared the encampment and made arrests. In the Midwest, an encampment at the center of the University of Michigan's campus had grown to nearly 40 tents, and 9 anti-war protesters at the University of Minnesota were arrested Tuesday morning after police took down an encampment a couple of hours after it was set up in front of the library. Since the war in Gaza began October 7th, colleges and universities have struggled to balance safety with free speech rights. Many long-tolerated protests, but are now doling out more discipline. Harvard University in Massachusetts has tried to stay a step ahead of protests by locking most gates into the famed Harvard Yard and limiting access to those with school identification. The school has also posted signs that warn against setting up tents or tables on campus without permission. Ben Wisner, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union, said college leaders face tough decisions because they had a responsibility to ensure people could express their views even when others found them offensive, but they also need to protect students from targeted harassment, threats, and intimidation, he said, and sometimes that line can seem like a gray one. From Tampa, Florida, President Joe Biden on Tuesday blamed Donald Trump for Florida's upcoming abortion ban and other restrictions across the country that have imperiled access to care for pregnant women, arguing Trump has created a health care crisis for women all over the country. Biden's campaign events at Hillsborough Community College in Tampa placed the president at the epicenter of the latest battle over abortion restrictions. The state's 6-week abortion ban is poised to go into effect May 1st, at the same time that Florida voters are gearing up for a ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution. Biden said millions of women are facing, quote, pain and cruelty. But it's not inevitable. We can stop it. When you vote, we can stop it, he said. The president is seeking to capitalize on the unceasing momentum against abortion restrictions nationwide to not only buoy his reelection bid in battleground states he won in 2020, but also to go on the offensive against Trump in states that the presumptive Republican nominee won 4 years ago. One of those states is Florida, where Biden lost to Trump by 3.3 percentage points. On Tuesday, he chronicled increasing medical concerns for women in the nearly 2 years since the Supreme Court ended federal abortion protections. There was one person who was responsible for that nightmare, Biden said, and he's acknowledged it and he brags about it, Donald Trump. Biden said Trump, who has publicly waffled on his abortion views and of late has said abortion is a matter for states to decide, is concerned voters will now hold him accountable. Folks, the bad news for Trump is that we are going to hold him accountable, Biden said. At the same time, advocates on the ground say support for abortion access cuts across parties. Their intent on making the issue as nonpartisan as possible as they work to scrounge up at least 60% support from voters for the ballot initiative. That could mean, in some cases, Florida voters would split their tickets backing GOP candidates while supporting the abortion measure. This gives voters an opportunity to have their message heard on one policy platform, said Lauren Brunzel, campaign director for Floridians Protecting Freedom, which gathered signatures to put the abortion question before voters. On the same day, the Florida Supreme Court ruled that the ballot measure could go before voters is also upheld the state's 15-week abortion ban, and that subsequently cleared the way for the new ban on the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy, which is often before women know they are sent. As Kamani said, she is encouraging the Biden administration to focus on the impact of a 6-week ban and let the ballot measure speak for itself. At the end of the day, the ballot initiative is going to be a multi-million-dollar campaign that stands very strongly on its own, Escalante said. Trump's campaign did not respond to a question on whether the former president, a Florida voter, would oppose or support the ballot measure. In an NBC interview last September, Trump called Florida's 6-week ban terrible, but he has repeatedly highlighted the three conservative-leaning justices he chose for the high court who cleared the way to overturn Roe. From Washington, nearly 2 years after overturning the constitutional right to abortion, the Supreme Court on Wednesday will consider how far state bans can extend to women in medical emergencies. The justices are weighing a case from Idaho where a strict abortion ban went into effect shortly after the High Court's 2022 decision overturning Roe versus Wade. The latest case marks the first time the Supreme Court has considered a state ban since then and comes as the justices consider another case still pending seeking to restrict access to abortion medication. The Biden administration argues that hospitals must be allowed to terminate pregnancies in rare emergencies where a patient's life or health is at serious risk, even in states where abortions are banned. Idaho says its law does have an exception for life-saving abortions, and it contends that Biden administration wants to define health emergencies more broadly to turn hospitals into abortion enclaves. Idaho is one of 14 states that now ban abortion at all stages of pregnancy with limited exceptions. Most Republican-controlled states have started enforcing new bans or restrictions since Roe was overturned, and 22 states filed court papers supporting Idaho. The Supreme Court has allowed the Idaho abortion ban to go into effect even during emergencies as the case played out. Idaho's ban has already affected emergency care in the state, said Dr. Jim Souza, the chief physician executive of Boise-based St. Luke's Health System. Since the law went into effect for emergencies in January, 6 pregnant emergency room patients have had to be flown out of state for treatment. Just one needed a similar emergency flight in all of 2023, he said. The Supreme Court is expected to rule by the end of June. And I have one news briefing. President Joe Biden will be the commencement speaker at Morehouse College in Georgia, giving the Democrat a key spotlight on one of the nation's preeminent historically black campuses, potentially exposing him to protests as he seeks re-election against former President Donald Trump. The White House confirmed Tuesday that Biden would speak May 19th at the alma mater of civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. and then address the graduating class at the United States Military Academy at West Point on May 25th. Morehouse's announcement has drawn some backlash among the school's supporters who are critical of Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war. By Tuesday afternoon, some Morehouse alumni were circulating online a letter that condemns the administration's invitation to Biden and seeking signatures to pressure Morehouse President David Thomas to rescind it. The letter said Biden's support for Israel effectively supports genocide in Gaza and runs counter to the pacifism that King expressed with his opposition to the Vietnam War.
Hi, I'm Trisha Beatty, a Chris Radio volunteer. If you need a ride to the store, a doctor's appointment, your job, or just to visit a friend, call Nutmeg Senior Rides. Nutmeg Senior Rides offers 24-hour service every day of the year to seniors and adults with visual impairment in Bloomfield, East Granby, East Windsor, Enfield, Granby, Summers, South Windsor, Suffield, Windsor, and Windsor Locks. This alternative transportation program uses a combination of volunteer and paid drivers who provide rides in private vehicles. There is no restriction on the purpose of a ride, and help is offered to carry packages, fold walkers, and open doors. That's why many feel that using Nutmeg Senior Rides is like riding with a friend. For more information, log on to nutmegseniorrides.org or call Margaret at 860-758-7833. That's 860-758-7833.
We're going to take our final break and then be back with the rest of the front pages after that. And our final stories will come from the Connecticut section of the Current. After facing pushback from Governor Ned Lamont, tech insiders and state officials, Senator James Maroney said he is nearing completion on a rewrite of a sweeping artificial intelligence bill that seeks to shield residents from discriminatory algorithms and criminalize the spread of certain AI generated pornographic and political material. The Senate signaled Monday that the next draft of the bill will sacrifice key regulatory measures to assuage concerns from small businesses, big tech, the governor, and the Department of Economic and Community Development, who fear too much regulation could push tech companies out of the state. Flanked by advocates, Senate leaders, and colleagues at a press conference Monday, Maroney said that the state must pass the AI protections this session. We have an obligation to act now, Maroney said. We know that there are harms that we need to address. The proposal would establish a framework to regulate AI algorithms and often work surreptitiously in the public with private sectors to decide anything from credit scores to social services interventions. It would also criminalize the spread of non-consensual AI-generated images, also known as deepfake, pornography, and AI-generated election material that falls under the bill's category of deceptive media. Maroney said Monday that the bill would also move AI innovation and adoption forward by funding AI education, training, and research, and requiring state agencies to determine how they may use AI to improve performance. With 16 days left in the legislative session, Senate President Pro Tempore Martin Looney said that passing Maroney's AI bill is a top priority. We believe that this has to come to a vote. It's such a critical issue, Looney said. This is fundamental. A version of the AI bill cleared the Judiciary Committee Monday in a bipartisan vote that was not without reservations from lawmakers who said they want to see changes to the language. This bill does remain something of a work in progress, Committee Chair Representative Steven Safstrom said. We'll support it today to continue the conversation, but I do certainly hope that amendments are made before this sees the House. House Speaker Matt Ritter told reporters that last week that he was sympathetic to arguments from the governor's office and DECD that some provisions of the bill may be onerous on smaller tech startups. After speaking with the Lamont administration, Maroney said he plans to scrap certain provisions in the original bill that applied to general purpose AI model developers. Maroney said the now deleted section was causing the most angst among a lot of large companies. In a series of photos shown in a New Haven courtroom on Tuesday afternoon, graduate student Kevin Jiang posed proudly outside Yale University, beaming toward the camera against the backdrops of the historic buildings on campus not far from where he would be gunned down in 2021 by Quinsocken Pan. Pan, an MIT researcher, was sentenced Tuesday to 35 years in prison for Young's slaying after pleading guilty in February as part of a plea agreement. On February 6, 2021, Jiang had just dropped his fiancée, Zion Perry, off at her home in New Haven. When gunshots rang out, Jiang was found lying on Lawrence Street with multiple close-range gunshot wounds to his face, a prosecutor said in court Tuesday. He died from his wounds, and his death was ruled a homicide. After a three-month nationwide manhunt that involved the FBI, United States Marshals, and police officers from several states, from New York to North Carolina, Pan was arrested in an Alabama apartment on May 14, 2021, and charged with Jiang's murder. Investigators learned that he had known Perry at MIT, though the two had not remained in contact other than on social media. Prosecutors said Tuesday that forensic evidence linked Pan to the murder, including Jiang's DNA on his winter hat. The killing, loved ones said at the sentencing, was a hateful plot motivated by jealousy. Not far from the grounds of the university, where Jiang was a graduate student at the Yale School of Environment, his loved ones filled the courtroom at Pan's sentencing, watching a montage of photos play out showing Jiang's bright, wide smile. Nearly 50 people packed the courtroom, including Perry, her parents, and Jiang's parents. As many quietly wiped tears from their eyes, Pan looked at the screen on his feet, showing no emotion. One after another, nearly a dozen people stepped forward to express their devastation, grief, sorrow, and fear in the wake of Jiang's murder. They shared memories of Jiang, some speaking through sobs, as they begged the judge for a harsher sentence, others addressing Pan directly and offering forgiveness. 56 years ago, Gerald Mike Fothergill walked out of high school in response to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and was told by court administrators, by school administrators, he could never return. This was in the spring of 1968. Fothergill, now 75, is still fighting to get his Harford Public High School diploma all these years later. In my senior year, I admit I wasn't a great student, but I wasn't a quitter, Fothergill said. There's nothing in my mind to do that. Fothergill said the day after King died, the majority of students that Friday morning asked their teachers if the school was going to allow for an early release. The day after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, a little over 4 years earlier, in 1963, Harford Public Schools held a half day so students could grieve. Fothergill said he, along with several other students, thought the Friday would be no different this time. But the announcement never came. Expecting the school to comply with all these emotional kids, they refused, Fothergill said. At some point after lunch, almost all the kids left. I proceeded to walk out the back door and march down Farmington Avenue. Fothergill, then 19, along with hundreds of other students, some black and some white, took part in the peaceful walkout as an emotional response to the slain civil rights leader's death. Some of the students wept and others remained silent, but all of them were peaceful, he said. Fothergill admits he was a member of the Black Panther Party, but he said he never participated in any rule-breaking. Students from all classes joined in. Fothergill's classmate Ann Goss-Digian said during the public comments section of a recent Board of Education meeting, this was an organic, unplanned, peaceful walkout. It was not a protest, a demonstration, an insurrection, or a riot. It was a group of grieving teenagers who walked down Forest Street to Farmington Avenue. They stopped at St. Joseph Cathedral for a few minutes of prayer, and with the help of a police escort, they walked to City Hall, where they were met on the steps by then-Mayor Ann Uccello. On the Monday morning after the walkout, Fothergill was sent into the principal's office and told he was going to be expelled from the school. A letter would be sent out notifying his parents. After a few days of processing what had just happened between the momentous assassination and his own expulsion, his mother drove him to the Board of Education headquarters on High Street. There they pleaded with administrators to allow him to attend adult education classes to make up credits lost, but officials refused to let him complete his education. He said Father Gould quickly learned he was the only student given such a harsh punishment. I was singled out, and I don't know why, Father Gould said. They automatically expelled me. When you take my file and send it to the Board of Education and have them expel me from that point without question, it is something that violated my civil rights. What were the charges? And I'm going to just jump to the end of this article because I have one more I'd like to read. When they expelled me, this is him speaking, whenever expelled me, when they did that, they put on a whole different plane. Now it wasn't me fighting for my diploma. It was the rights they took from me, Father Gould said. I'm looking for them to justify this and rectify it. I just want to clear my name. They don't even know what the charges are. If they can't find out, they should nullify